This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. All is well.
Fantastic. All right. So today we've got a couple of questions on casual mating strategy, the evolutionary psychology perspective of spiritual experiences, and if we have time, a question about sibling rivalry. So without further ado, Dr. Lyle, you ready for these?
Sure. Let's go.
All right. Dear Dr. Lyle, after a one-night stand, the guy asked me on a date. I met a man at a social dancing event and invited myself over to his place to have sex. I was on a rebound from a bad breakup and was just looking for a one-night stand. Well, aside from great sex, this man turned out to be smart, agreeable, conscientious, open to experience, although a bit shy, with a great sense of humor, and a PhD student on top of it all. The next day, he asked me out to dinner as friends, which ended up being a first date. Now, we live in different cities, but he keeps calling and texting me, which makes me very happy. How can I tell if this is going anywhere? Is this all genuine, or are we both falling for some kind of psychological trap, self-delusional trap? I obviously didn't do the 10 paid dates, so does it mean that I blew my chances to truly test and grow this potential relationship? If we go on a date again, he is clearly going to expect sex, and to be honest, I want it too. What should we do? I'm in my 30s and have a child from a previous relationship. I'm rather disagreeable and can be a bit neurotic, hence the top qualities. Oh, yeah, I'm rather disagreeable because I'm a lawyer and can be a bit neurotic, hence the top qualities I'm looking for in a man are agreeableness and emotional stability.
Now, where was she when I was a PhD student? there's nothing in the world wrong with this. And so this is all, all we could say is good luck and we'll see what happens. And no, you didn't wreck your chances. You've lowered your chances. You lowered your chances just because there's a possibility when women give up sex that easily, it's possible that the male might infer that he's fancier and therefore takes some of the shine out of the female. So we would expect that inference would be made. Those inferences are made in all kinds of negotiations over cars, houses, and everything else under the sun. So when the other side senses that we are a very easy target, they infer that they're in a position of power, and then they start to essentially analyze reasons why that's true. So it would be natural for human beings to assume that they're simply fancier. Would be reasonable for a male to assume that he's simply fancier if a female gives it up easily. So, but that doesn't blow your chances. It means that he might make that mistake if that is in fact a mistake. So the 10 paid dates is a general strategy. Just doesn't have to be 10, doesn't have to be 8, doesn't have to be anything. It's a general strategy to avoid exploitation. And so it's not a hard and fast rule for anything. And in this case, this young woman, was just sort of being a horny animal. Fair enough, okay. And so it turns out that she may have tripped her way into a good situation. We'll know a great deal more in 30 days or 90 days. And we'll find out where it all goes. So good luck, and let's hope that that you have found something exceptional in and great. All right, let's go on.
Now, oh, okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I had a question is that if this lady decides to withhold sex next time, does that lower her chances of pair bonding or mate value? I mean, does this kind of disturb and distort the male's perspective?
Yeah, it's sort of a weird thing to do this at this point. And the reason is that to be like, huh, what the hell? Like, why is that going on? So I wouldn't be playing games with the male at that point. The whole point of withholding early is is essentially to sink the inference in that you're not weak in the knees and therefore that you are not that you don't consider yourself less than and you don't want them making those inferences. And so that's where we are here. But, you know, this already took place. There's no sense in now at this point, we just have to trust the process that as these two people get to know each other better, you know, they haven't had a hell of a lot of conversation, but they've had some. And, you know, it's the risk is obviously that if we now in the next month, these people get together half a dozen times, they sleep together. And then a month from now, this guy is finding suddenly that he's just not as interested as he thought he was. And, you know, in fact, they are a long ways apart. And in fact, this and in fact, that, and she's sorry. Okay. Fair enough. She, her degree of heartbreak may be significantly more, just because she is sort of more emotionally invested as a result of making herself potentially pregnant and therefore more vulnerable psychologically. So that price is obviously likely to be higher, but what the heck, this person's got some grit, got some toughness. And so I trust that she can handle it. So we'll see how it goes. And by no means does this strategy mean that you can't have a great relationship develop behind it. We just understand that we're you know, increasing the risk factor that two bad things could happen. Number one, we're being played by a casual mating strategy player, and we didn't want to be. Or number two, that we actually caused the person to infer our value as less than it is. So those are two risk factors when females give up access to their sexuality easily and early. Those are neither one of those is these days need be prohibitive. And so good luck. We'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, in a lot of the casual mating that we've discussed on the show, it's mm-hmm. been where the male is pursuing the female. But in this case, it appears mm-hmm. that the female was clearly playing casual mating strategy and pursuing the male.
Right. Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think she was pretty impressed. So I think that's what we're seeing. Right time of the month for her nervous system, right social context with dancing, where you can get a lot of data about a person's sexuality and you get close to them physically, et cetera. So all, you know, get music that's, you know, tickling the neural circuits in some interesting and intriguing ways. And it all comes together and there you go. So, yeah, it's not like women can't be interested from the jump. It's just that they're usually not. So that's so in this case, we had a nice elixir that all came together, maybe with or without alcohol. And so we will. And so, hey, yeah, the guy got himself a nice little perfect storm, and it certainly worked out well for him. And now we'll see how well it works out for her.
Fascinating. All right, Dr. Lasso, you and I are going to the next social dancing event. We can be each other's wingmen.
we need to. You and I are looking at very different music, Chief. All right.
But you don't like polka as much as I do?
Yeah. All right. Let's see what we got.
Speaking of spiritual experiences, how does evolutionary psychology interpret spiritual experiences? Particularly the experience of, quote, oneness, or what this listener is describing as, quote, dissolving of boundaries between the self and others that can occur during meditation, prayer, and sometimes even during fasting. If the purpose of life is simply to further one's personal happiness in order to maximize gene survival, Why do people become dissatisfied with the baubles of status that they have acquired, which by any objective measurement would maximize their gene survival? And instead, they turn to a spiritual understanding of the purpose of life instead. This person cites an example of Russell Brand, who ascended the ladder of success in spectacular fashion, acquiring money status, allowing him to attract the most desirable mates, but found the whole experience completely unsatisfying and turned to meditation and spirituality to find happiness instead.
Nice letter. Let's see. So how does evolutionary psychology interpret spiritual experiences? Well, we would begin by understanding that any feeling that you have is a signaling device that is wired into your evolutionary history, that if it's positive, it means that feeling or those circumstances increased your likelihood of gene survival. And it turns out that if it feels negative, then those experiences or those inputs from the environmental situation that are activating those neural circuits are associated with circumstances that reduced your ancestors' odds of success. So if we start talking about the dissolving of boundaries between the self and others, I can think very clearly about how a feeling of dissolving the boundaries between oneself and others would increase the likelihood of gene survival.
Our previous question.
That's not very hard to figure out. Okay. And you can also, I'm not sure what this means by dissolving of boundaries, but a feeling of that we are in solidarity, that we are, that we have a minimal conflict of interest between us here in this moment, et cetera. Of course, those would be circumstances that our ancestors would have experienced at particular times under particular social situations that would have caused them to feel good, just like it feels good when you have, you know, the cessation of hostilities in a war and people get to walk home and the war is over, okay? So I don't think that there's anything particularly mysterious about that other than, occur during meditation, prayer, and even fasting. I'm not sure what kind of thing they're talking about. Sometimes when people water fast and they have done this in certain ways, of course, Nathan is a doctor that's extremely knowledgeable in water fasting. You know that if people water fast, and they don't get enough water, they're going to start hallucinating.
Right. Yeah. And hundreds of years ago, they would call them medicine men.
Right. Right.
Before they knew that it was dehydration. Yeah,
they're right. So now we got meditation. Okay. I'm not sure what spectacular feeling that is, other than some people can calm down a lot of anxiety there. And prayer. I'm not sure what that is either. This is sort of feeling like there's a benign, you know, omnipotent or omniscient or powerful being with whom you can have some kind of contact, and somehow that you feel there's a benevolent dominance that makes you feel safer. So I can imagine many circumstances, and particularly among primitive peoples, that they were their own. They were their own survival troop. Their survival and success or failure was going to depend on that group. And they also, no doubt, for reasons that we'll explore in future podcasts, evolved religious circuitry inside their minds, likely contributing to some of these feelings that this person is talking about, feelings of solidarity and oneness with our fellow brethren, et cetera. and so then they go on and say, the purpose of life is to simply further one's personal happiness in order to maximize gene survival. I just want to point out, this isn't nitpicking, this is just trying to be precise. The purpose of your life is to maximize gene survival. That's not the same thing as pursuing your happiness. the purpose of life, of your life, doesn't have to be maximizing gene survival, but the purpose of life is to maximize gene survival. So therefore, the neural architecture and the physical architecture of all living things and the neural architecture of things that have neurons, i.e. animals, behavior regulation mechanisms, those are absolutely designed to compute environmental contingencies against the individual body's strengths and weaknesses, and to plot a behavioral trajectory in real time, moment by moment, that would optimize gene survival. It's the best guess that the computer has. Now, human beings can co-opt some of the machinery. Some of that machinery is going to be what we call good moods. And good moods are what we call happiness. Some people get ethereal about happiness, about it's some nirvana state somewhere in Shangri-La. And we'll have Three Dog Night sing a song about it. But that's not what happiness is. What happiness is ephemeral state of the brain that takes place when the computations of the brain are coming up with a printout that says that the current circumstances are good for gene survival. And when the current circumstances have significant threats to gene survival and they've gotten worse, for example. So essentially, mood states are trend indicators that will tell us whether or not things are getting better or things are getting worse. The reason why you need a trend indicator is that if things are getting better, even if they're shitty, if things are getting better, you start feeling better immediately. And the reason why that's true is the system needs to know, it needs a guidance system like a compass to tell it which behaviors seem to be effective at increasing our likelihood of gene survival. So, you could be in really bad shape. You could be in a tremendous amount of pain. And then, you drink some watermelon juice and 6 minutes later you feel quite a bit better. Don't think that you don't notice that. So your purpose, the purpose that your architecture, physical and psychological architecture was designed for, was maximizing gene survival. However, human beings can notice that sometimes maximizing gene survival isn't the same thing as maximizing their happiness. And so that's what Beat Your Genes is all about. It's about essentially trying to outthink the machine that built you. And is it possible? Well, of course it's possible. That's what birth control is. Birth control is the ultimate example of beating the genes. In other words, we want the same sex and lust and satisfaction and orgasms that take place with those are all of the incentives that the neural architecture put into your into you by virtue of gene design in order to get the damn genes reproduced. So the genes created that architecture. They created the possibility of you having those experiences because they evolve little by little to make those extremely gratifying in order to get the genes reproduced. That turned out to be how the biochemistry of nature turns out to get that done. Now, along the way, it's willing to have screaming little brats keep you awake at night forever and basically have you ready to kill your spouse for the idea of ever having a kid. Okay. So the point is that there's nothing about having a kid that optimizes your happiness. Now, it would also be surprising that if having a child were not without great happiness potential for activating your circuits. So it can. And there might actually be, watching them to be successful could be extraordinarily gratifying, and it usually is for parents because they're human parents, and human parents invest heavily in those offspring survival. Believe me, sharks don't smile and grin and brag to each other about how that their shark just ate some tuna fish and then they're going to get laid. No, because they're not connected in that way. Human beings' neural architecture makes it so that their happiness is extraordinarily complex in the sense that there are many situations that the human being is able to compute about what is and what isn't likely to be good or bad for gene survival and have its moods shift subtly and dynamically along the good bad dimension as these feelings essentially tell the story to the organism about what its behavioral strategy should be in the next moment. Now the person's question is, you know, how does evolutionary psychology interpret its spiritual experiences? Well, we know what spiritual experiences are. They're no different than any other experiences. So whatever the woo-woo feelings that the organism is capable of having, those were built into the neural design as a way to statistically increase the likelihood of gene survival. Now the person goes on and says, well, wait a second, haven't there people transcended this? There's this guy, Russell Brand, who super successful, got a lot of money and so forth. So why is it that he turned to meditation and spirituality to find happiness instead? Found the experience of ascending status hierarchies wholly unsatisfying. I don't think so, or he wouldn't have been that successful. So I think we can see that whoever Russell Brand is, I don't know who he is. This is the first time I've heard his name. I've heard of Steve Jobs, and I've heard of Warren Buffett, and I've heard of Bill Gates, but I haven't heard of Russell Brand. So I don't think he got to the top of the dominance hierarchy. But he was clearly a successful guy and got a lot of money and status behind it. And yet he decided to do something different with his existence. And the reason why he did something different with it from his existence is because the things that were giving him satisfaction and clearly gave him a great deal of satisfaction in the pursuit of those things, they had diminishing returns. So as a result, he started realizing, well, wait a second, if I got like $40 million, what's 41 going to do? And it's not necessarily that easy to make 41. So is it, you know, am I on the Forbes 400? I might be quite a ways away from that. Am I a billionaire? Yeah, but you know what? Then nobody even knows my name, hardly. So as a result, what this person might have done, and I'm only speculating, of course, but since we're having an example, the whole point of an example is to try to estimate why this would happen in principle, whether it would happen with where these specific reasons for this specific. What's that? Yeah.
He's a stand-up comedian.
Oh, he's a stand-up comedian?
Yeah, and then he is an author or a radio host. What's that?
No, not a billionaire. Okay, so we're really
sure. English comedian, actor, radio host.
Yeah, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So it's going to turn out that now I'm hearing the story for the first time about his name. And I'm hearing about that he turned his back on the acquiring of money and status and instead did this other thing. Really? Why am I hearing his name? I'm hearing his name because he's achieving status in another domain. That's what I'm hearing. Okay. Yeah, if it was so satisfying to just meditate quietly and pursue your quiet spirituality on a little river somewhere, in North Wales where nobody is, and just toss little rocks into a stream, then he would have been finding his happiness there and I wouldn't be hearing this story. But I live in California. I never heard of this guy. And so now I'm hearing this guy's name because he has done this completely different thing. Yeah? I don't think so. So what we really see is the story, no matter what this specific individual's process has been, and so hopefully what he found was that there was another status market that was more satisfying for him to pursue. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's reasonable. Those are different women. There's different women are going to be it's a different psychological human that would be attracted to a guy who's a spiritual guru as opposed to a guy who's driving a Rolls Royce and fancy motorcycles and telling jokes on stage. Different market. So he may find that his personality is more attracted to those individuals, and therefore this is a smarter way to go about accessing that market. In other words, it's a better advertisement for who he is.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be, you know, things are going to happen. People are going to change. I remember one of the people that I admire most in this world now passed is Harry Brown. And Harry Brown, when he wrote his best-selling book, How to Profit from the Coming Devaluation, he's an investment advisor and all this, so he's in a shirt and tie. And that's the picture. And he got lucky. In other words, he wrote this book, and very soon after that, they devaluated the currency in America. And so Brown became a bit of a star in the financial world. He didn't have any formal education. He didn't have an MBA from Harvard. He didn't have anything. He was just a high school educated guy with a lot of brains. And he had analyzed the situation carefully, self-educated in economics. And then he called it right. And he got lucky. And as a result of that newfound success, we then got to see who he really was. And in the jacket photo of his magnificent book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, you see Harry Brown, not clean shaven, but with a beard. And you don't see him in a suit and tie. You see him in some sloppy shirt, just like, hey, he's kicking back, okay? You get to see the real dude because now he realizes, hey, I can now be myself and expose to the world more clearly. I don't have to play so carefully and defend my status and look, credible. I can now be who I am. So now Russell so-and-so here is now able, he had a bunch of success, and he now is able to do something that is potentially more aligned with who he is, and good luck to him. And I hope he's not in the enlightenment trap, which is the notion that we're pretending that we have transcended the need to earn esteem. That doesn't happen. And so he has not transcended such a need.
Wow.
All right.
Do we want to talk a little bit more about what you just said, the enlightenment trap? Or do we want to leave that for...
I don't know. Well, I think we talked about this before, but yeah, and there's a set of situations or a set of options that human beings have when it comes to not competing in a given domain. And so if you are struggling in a competitive domain, no matter what that domain is, whether it's commerce, whether it's athletics, whether it's attractiveness, whether it's mating, whether it's friendship, whatever the domain is, if you are not achieving what it is that you are thinking that you should achieve or you would like to achieve, then you're likely to become frustrated. And then if you continue to put greater efforts in and continue to fail, you're likely to get depressed. So depression is going to be the necessary result of failure that will cause you to rethink and reanalyze and seek new information and basically pause on the output of energy on that behavioral strategy, because that behavioral strategy is not yielding the results that it would appear that they should. So if you keep knocking on doors and saying, can I get a job here? Can I work here? And you do that 37 times and everybody says no, then you start to stop doing it and you start thinking about how else you can do it. And you may sit down on a street corner and look depressed and put your head in your hands. And some guy may stop by and say, hey, what's the matter, kid? And you say, well, I just have knocked on every door on the street and I ask them if they got a job for me and they say no. And you say, well, that's not how you do it. Let me explain how you could say that differently, how it is that you could pitch differently. And let me explain why it is that that's not the best way to pitch it. And so if somebody gives you some instruction, possibly because that they see you're failing and see that you're psychologically you're essentially emotionally in pain, i.e. depressed. So they see this, whether it's your mom, your dad, your sister, your brother, your cousin, your friend, your coach. When they see you depressed, that expression of depression is not an accident. That's by evolutionary design for you to feel it, and it's by evolutionary design for you to express it in your body posture, facial expressions, voice tone, and even the words that you select. So as a result, you communicate that you're defeated and that you're out of ideas and that you no longer are willing to put out energy to compete in this arena, but you are confused. In other words, you're depressed when you feel like you should have succeeded, but you cannot. And so then, if somebody gives you new information, that may well, if it looks plausible, it'll fire up your motivation, and you won't be depressed anymore. You may be anxious, and you're excited, and you're a little worried, but you're not depressed. You will shift out of that as the systems of emotion will cause you to be willing to expend energy along a new trajectory. Now, if it turns out that that you believe that other people actually have expectations higher than you believe you yourself can achieve, then you're in the ego trap. And the reason why you're somewhat depressed, but you're also intimidated, and you're essentially hiding from the competitive problem. That's different than being depressed and then eliciting information to face the competitive problem. So those are two different places where the human being can be, okay? Another place that they can be is that they can act like they have transcended the need to compete. So it's a pose. It's a flim-flam. So I am above it all. I no longer pursue wealth. I don't need wealth. I no longer pursue to try to look cool for the opposite sex or the same sex if I'm so inclined or whatever. I am beyond that. I no longer, I'm above it. I have found, you know, higher things in human nature to dedicate my time and energy to. Sure you have. This is a posture, okay? And so it's a posture of an individual who is selecting an option here. There's another option that we will talk about, and we will fill in the blanks on the options. I believe that there are four options for people who are failure. One of them is to be depressed and then go down that direction. Another is to be ego-trapped. Another is to pretend to be enlightened. And there's a fourth that I'm not going to reveal here because we are going to have in the upcoming weeks a brilliant newly minted PhD out of Harvard University by the name of Jen Hawk. We'll give her analysis of the fourth option. And in doing so, we will see in the coming weeks and months how the tentacles of her analysis of option number four will weave their way through political processes, social processes, cultural processes, and the individual processes of human beings who get in certain situations where it's in their best interest to not compete. So the enlightenment trap is one of these versions. And so the person that wrote this seems to me, by the tone and the wording and the choices of the phrases, seems to me to have been bamboozled by Russell Brand's possible enlightenment pose. If he's not making that pose, somebody else is right now all over the world. And every guru is making this sort of pose that they're above it all. And it's a bluff. And as we would expect, when you're attempting to optimize your status, one of the ways you would do it is by bluffing. And so the enlightenment trap is one of, I believe, four versions. And we're going to keep looking very carefully about whether or not there's a fifth or a sixth, if there's some things we're missing. But I think Dr. Hawk has got this analyzed. I think it's down to four. And so, so this is one of the big ones. And it's a clever as hell strategy, and sometimes it works, which is why we got this question.
Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating that you say that, because I can see this all over. I mean, I suspected that that if this is true, I mean, of course, this is coming from a listener who's describing Russell Brand. So we have, you know, so of course.
Yeah. I have no idea about Russell specifically. Right.
Right. Exactly. But it's interesting because I suspect, just like what you said, is if somebody has dedicated their life for status seeking, as we all do, mm-hmm. and they mm-hmm. achieve all the money and all the status, and they still haven't figured out what it is that they want to figure out, which is what you talk about on the podcast, human source code, what life is all about, and essentially clearing up distortions. You can imagine, I can imagine someone searching for that. And after having achieved so much, they still don't know that. So they can become depressed. And if they listen and they hear something that corrects a distortion. Now they get very elated and they have what I guess they call a spiritual experience. And then as they ruminate on it, they may realize, uh-oh, no, never mind. It's not all that it's cracked out to be. And so they eventually give up and say, well, I'm just going to go meditate and be spiritual to try to find it.
You know, that's why we're talking. That's why. That's why this young doctor got my attention several years ago, folks, is because he's damn smart. Excellent, Nathan. That's very good thinking. And so this is a people that have been very successful may absolutely find that tons of pseudo-esteem is not actually causing their happiness circuits to go off. And they're a little bit lost and confused by that because the whole thing looks like it's a big, massive free-for-all to try to get as much pseudo-esteem as you could possibly get so that the whole world knows your name and feels awe behind it. And yet, if that even happens to you, it may not cause moods of happiness to go off because moods of happiness are going to go off when you have earned esteem in the right way from the people that matter. And so this is so absolutely people like this gentleman and other people could absolutely be realizing, wait a second, I managed to get even more successful than I would have thought, but it wasn't in the right way from the people that matter. And so as a result, they wander the earth looking for something, and they may find themselves in a spiritual pursuit of some kind, trying to find a compass that takes them home. And what we are doing here is trying to identify explicitly with the lens of science and theory of evolution to try to figure out what that path is. And I think we know. I think that once you look at human motivational architecture through the lens of evolution, it becomes crystal clear what it is that will really work. And what works is, you know, figure out who it is that matters to you most. Who do you admire? Who are you attracted to? Who do you love? You know, what is it that and who is it that is most valuable to you? And then you go seek the esteem, earning it in the right way from those individuals. No shortcuts, no bluffing. That doesn't mean you have to be perfect and you're not going to make mistakes. We're all going to do that. But the general compass says, be real, be honest, do your excellent thing as a human that you can do in order to engage in trade processes with the people that you find the most valuable for you. And that is where your happiness will be found.
Hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating because I wonder if there was ever an investigation as to the professions of people who end up, you know, feeling like they haven't found enlightenment, you know what I mean, or they haven't found the truth, is if it happens to be more entertainers and unstable type jobs. You know, this guy is obviously a comedian, so a lot more pseudo-esteem possibilities than, say, someone like Steve Jobs, who actually produced quite a bit, you know what I mean? Whereas I've talked to a couple of entertainers and they feel like they didn't produce as much for the village. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Fascinating. Really good thinking. Yeah. Entertainment industry literally by design is pseudo-esteem. I mean, literally, if you're a great actor, you're playing a part for God's sakes. You didn't do the thing that the hero in the part did. You just played the part. So you can be getting pseudo-esteem as if you were the hero that played the part, but you didn't do anything of the kind. And so, yeah, that whole arena is, as you would say, rife for a bunch of distortion, confusion, and some possibly disillusioned successful people. So all good. Great thinking.
Very interesting. All right, our next question. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to turn the ship around a little bit. Instead of pseudo-esteem, now we're talking about sibling rivalry. Interesting to me because the first time I heard about sibling rivalry was in my psychology class in college, and it didn't make any sense. But what made sense to me was when you talked about something to do with siblings. I think one of the first lectures I heard you talk about, you just mentioned in passing that I believe it was that mothers will lose the kids, you know, if they lose track of their kids, it'll be the least attractive ones more so than the other ones.
Sure.
And I remember just getting lost all the time as a kid compared to my two sisters. And I just it's stuck with me ever since. You
lucky
traumatized
you had
some me, Dr. Lyle.
To find yourself home.
All right. So
yeah.
Let's
All right.
Ask.
Let's hear it.
Oh yeah. Did you want to say something about that study? Did I?
Yeah. No. No. Go right ahead. Let's hear the sibling.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, when there's multiple siblings in a family, which do the parents tend to favor the most? For example, my brother is much. This is not my sister writing this. My brother is much less attractive to me, a bit less smart than I am, a bit more agreeable, but very, very conscientious and therefore a better trader. My dad blatantly sends him many more positive esteem signals than myself. While I've accepted this treatment on an emotional level, I'm still interested as to why it exists on an intellectual level. I'm 30 and he's 27. I'm married with a child and he's never had a girlfriend. However, this favoritism started back way back in high school when my dad would treat his football coaches to steak dinners and then give my brother growth hormones to get bigger. Is this because he was hoping to improve his overall fitness? I would ultimately consider my brother a 5. What say you, Dr.
There you go. Yeah. yeah, all good observations. This looks like this isn't some conjured up letter that Dear Abby wrote to herself so that she could have a cute answer. No, this is the real deal. And so we're seeing all the threads here as they come together. In this case, I'm hearing about one sibling. So let's just assume for the sake of argument that we have two siblings. Maybe there's 4 in the family, but we're going to, and it wouldn't matter, but it's particularly obvious if there's 2. So you can imagine that I want you to imagine a poor family and there's 7 children and there are 6 dusters that aren't fancy and there's 1 genetic star. The right move from that poor family in Bangladesh or wherever they are, or, in Southeast Louisiana or whatever the heck it is, the right thing to do is to put your chips on the winner. If you've got 1 that may break out and ascend hierarchies and become very successful, the right thing to do is to put your chips on that one. If, however, you've got quite a few chips, you're, a middle American, solid, decent family with plenty of resources, and you've got 2 kids, and one of them is clearly genetically superior to the other. They're better looking, they're smarter, they're taller, they're more athletic, they're more suave, everything about them. Then your job as a parent is to actually optimize your own genetic success. So the winner is going to have plenty of resources to make sure that they optimize their trajectory. Unlike the winner that's coming from some little dust bowl where there's hardly enough resources to get them out to the market. In that case, we've got to get that individual out to the market where they can compete and thrive. In this case, we don't have to do that. So this guy, the person that wrote this letter, had plenty of resources, perfectly good English, completely intelligent, obviously follows complex arguments that we talk about here, plenty of chops, married, kid, done. Okay? If you're the parents of these 2 kids, you look at the situation and look how true it is. So here we are now, the child is now, at one point, the difference between the ages was 10 and 7, and the older child was clearly solid as a rock, going to be successful, and all was going to be well. We didn't have to worry about that one. We have to just make sure that they have enough resources that they're not hampered in their competitive pursuit in the marketplace. Our problem is with the 7-year-old. It's with the little brother. Clearly, the little brother's in trouble. So what we're going to do is we are going to give that little brother all these same signals. You're so important. We love you. We're behind you. Whatever it is that you need to compete, we're going to do everything we can. We're going to even give you steroids as a teenager, for God's sakes. And what is the outcome? Nothing. 27 years old. No girlfriend, never had one. Oops. So I'm not so sure the brother's a 5. The mother may be a 3. Okay. All things considered, that kid's in trouble. So might be a 5. Who knows? But behaviorally, definitely not a 5, because the average 5 has had a girlfriend by the time they're 27. So here we are. The dad was reading the situation perfectly and realizing that what needed to happen was the resources needed to be differentially more heavily invested in the less genetically successful kid. And that's what's going on. So you can see that it isn't a simple algorithm where, oh, we always invest in the fancy one, or we always invest in the low end one. No, it's dynamic. It depends upon the entire context of the situation, and the genes are smart enough to say, how should you expend your resources as a parent? Okay. One of the sad things that any of us have seen is how mammals in nature will treat their children. And I can remember watching a documentary on a tiger, and Mama Tiger had three cubs, and it was heartbreaking because they said three cubs is tough for a mom to raise, and they probably won't all make it. And so what happened is it showed that within you know, a couple of months, the two of the cubs were big and strong and healthy, and the third one was definitely the runt, and it was in trouble. And it was having a hard time keeping up and would start to straggle behind. And mom never looked back and didn't care. Okay, and that third cub was one day missing from the camera crew, and it was gone. And the mom didn't have the resources and was not designed psychologically to be trying to make sure they all lived. We're throwing three of them at the wall. We're going for two out of three. If we get lucky and all three happen to make it and we're in a benign environment, then what the hell? But we're not going to sweat it when the runt gets in trouble. Humans are no doubt similarly ruthless, but fortunately are now not in circumstances where they have to be that way. And so what you're seeing here is the opposite, which is that, hey, we don't have to worry about the star. We have to worry about the runt. And so that's what's actually going on here.
Wow. Fascinating. Well,
all right.
All right, Dr. Lyle. I think that's it for this evening. I think that's it for this evening. We will wrap it up and we'll talk to everybody next week. Dr. Lyle, thank you very much as always. We look forward to hearing from you next week.
Thank you, Nate. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.